Forever Dog.
Hey folks, it's me, Ben Blacker, the creator and host of the Writers Panel. This is a fun episode. A few years ago, my brother-in-law's sister, yeah, who was not my sister or my sister-in-law, got in touch to ask me if I or anyone I knew might want to participate in a class that she's teaching at DePaul University that was about showrunning. And I love this kind of thing. I love that this is an opportunity for young people who have real questions about the business and about the craft of writing get to ask those questions of someone who's been doing it for a long time. So I was happy to oblige. I sent Martha McGee a few folks over the past few years, and this year's speakers were as good as they've ever been. Today's episode is with the great Bridget Munoz-Leibowitz, who you know from Gordita Chronicles, One Day at a Time, Diary of a Future President, Brooklyn Nine-Nine, a whole bunch of stuff. She's been on the podcast a number of times, and those episodes are among my favorites. Definitely go check them out. We'll have another episode from a DePaul conversation, a really fascinating one, either later in December or in January with Javi Grillo-Marxwatch. And Javi, as you know, is always has great stuff to say, always terrific advice. But I love these Q&As. I love the opportunity it gives for folks who don't always have the opportunity to interact with professional writers. That's part of why I've been doing the newsletter, too. Thanks to so much of you for signing up at benblacker.substack.com. The exclusive to paid subscriber Q&As have been a blast. The first one we did with Robert Cargill, the writer of The Black Phone and Doctor Strange, was incredibly full of great information, as Cargill always is. The second one we did with House of the Dragons showrunner Ryan Condal was as full of terrific insights, and he got me to want to watch House of the Dragon, so I'm going to do that. He really, like, his approach to the show was so fascinating that it absolutely convinced me that I need to watch this show. Our next one is coming up on December the 3rd, and it is a great one. Jane Espenson is our guest. Jane has been at this for 25 years. There is no one better on craft than Jane Espenson. She thinks about writing in a way that is like a scientist. I've learned so much just from being her friend and talking to her in these podcasts over the years. So anyone who comes to that December 3rd Q&A with Jane Espenson is lucky to learn at her knee. And the only way to attend that is to become a paid subscriber. Go to benblacker.substack.com and get a monthly paid subscription or a yearly paid subscription. Or there's a special tier where I will read and note your script or outline, and then we'll have like an hour-long conversation about it. I've done a couple of those already, and they've been really fun. I love reading new writers. You're all so good at it. The competition is fierce. So use that opportunity. Go to benblacker.substack.com, and please join us on December 3rd to talk with Jane Espenson. Meantime, here is Bridget Munoz-Leibowitz with Martha McGee and the class at DePaul.
They write, they talk, and talk about what they write. Tune in tonight, or whenever the time is right. It's the Writers Panel with Ben Blacker, and it's starting now. Oh, yeah!
Welcome, welcome to the Writers Panel. Welcome to Bridget Munoz-Leibowitz. Bridget is a writer, producer, showrunner. She's worked on many, many shows, too many that I cannot tell you all of them in due time, but I will say the Gordita Chronicles, One Day at a Time, Love Life, Abby's, Diary of Future President, People of Earth, which I recently started watching, and Brooklyn Nine-Nine. One of the things she's currently working on, one of the many things, is the reboot of Who's the Boss with Mike Royce and someone named Norman Lear. This is welcome to our showrunning one class at DePaul. we are looking at show running from five different sides. There's so many things to a showrunner's job, but as a writer, as a producer, as a director, as a manager, and as even most importantly, a leader. So I will start it off, and then I'm just going to give it to the class. I just wanted to ask, what was your first job in the industry, and how did you get that job?
That's a great question. I'll give you, I think that my jobs in the industry came in two different phases. I had jobs when I was an undergrad that were technically in the industry, and I'll let you know what those were just to give your students an example of the kinds of jobs that are relevant to, because you never know where they're going to lead. So when I was in school at USC, I had an internship through the LA County Internship for the Arts program. And I worked at the American Film Institute as an assistant to their graduate students in the producing program, who were producing their thesis films and the directing workshop for women short films. So through that, my job was just to be helpful, to do production coordinating for them, get insurance certificates, whatever they needed, help find locations. It was an exposure to production at like the graduate level that ended up inspiring me to pursue my own graduate degree in producing. So that was like technically my first paid job in the industry. But once I was out of or in graduate school, my actual first job on a set on a movie was on a movie called Motherhood, starring Minnie Driver and Uma Thurman, directed by Katherine Diekman. And the line producer of that movie, named Robin Sweet, brought me on as her assistant. And Robin Sweet has gone on to do all kinds of television, including Better Call Saul and Castle Rock. She's a fabulous producer who I learned so, so much from. And she was my mentor in my first iteration of what I did before I was a TV writer, which was I was a line producer and a production manager. So that was my first job.
You were just speaking about grad school, and I really wanted to ask you for like aspiring showrunners, staff writers, just like people who want to work in the writer's room. Do mm-hmm. you see like graduate school as like a necessary step or just like something you could do?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. I get asked this a lot. For me, it was the absolute right choice. I felt when I graduated from USC that I was not prepared to go out and get a job as a writer, partly because I just turned 21 when I graduated, and there is an age bias a little bit in the industry, and I was unable to get representation when I graduated undergrad. And that showed me that I still had a ways to go in maturing as a writer. And the opportunities available to me for work at that point were being an assistant at a management or an agency. And for some people, that ended up being like a great path for them, but I was not at all interested in that. So my options were at that point, you know, Teach for America, PAing, which is fine, but again, wasn't a big interest for me at the time, and going to grad school. And so because I felt like I still needed to learn a lot more, I chose going to grad school, partly just to improve my skills, but also because I wanted to gain skills that were going to put me a cut above other people and enable me to produce my own work. A lot of the feedback that I got when I was starting out writing was that nobody was interested in the kinds of stories that I wanted to tell. They were like very like cutesy, quirky indie comedies. That's what I was into at the time. And nobody was interested in that. I believed in my work. And so I said, well, I'm going to learn how to do it myself. And that's what motivated me to go to graduate school. But I've met tons of people who didn't even finish college, honestly, who are now working writers, people that did go to grad school, people that went to medical school that are now working writers. There's no really one way in. If you feel like you're drawn to more education, like that's how you learn best, and that's how, or there's new skills that you didn't get in your undergraduate education that you kind of want a shortcut to, I'd recommend it. The other thing that I say about graduate school is that you're kind of paying for time to improve your craft. You know, it's like, it's 2 years, sometimes three, completely dedicated to refining your craft at a higher level. So when you get out there, you're generally a bit more prepared than a lot of other people. But that's not to say that you can't get a similar kind of training by having a day job and taking writing classes through something like Script Anatomy or UCLA Extension. I don't know if DePaul offers more classes, but like that's another way to go too. There's many ways to skin a cat. For me, it was the right choice.
Okay. And yeah. Was it like scary deciding like whether to like go into like more debt and like put off like making money to pay off said debt? Like what?
Yes.
Like how did you like cope with that anxiety? I guess is that what I'm asking.
Yes, that's a great question. So I was very fortunate to not have undergraduate debt. I had scholarships and my mom had saved up some money. So I was able to pay for the quarter of the tuition that I didn't get for scholarships. My mom was able to cover. So I know that that's incredibly rare. And I was very lucky to not have undergraduate debt. So I really didn't understand when I took on that debt, what I was really taking on. To give you guys a very, very honest picture of what student loan debt at the graduate level is like, at the time, Columbia was $60,000 a year, and that was for 2 years of classes. You can stay longer to work on your thesis and have health insurance and housing and do free internships, and they don't charge you tuition, but you can still be a student. So when I left graduate school, my debt, I think, was like $130,000 because I spent like $10,000 on a thesis film. And I was not able to pay my student loans back for probably like 8 years after that. I made like the minimum payment or I deferred. I was working, mm-hmm. I guess I was like working as a line producer or production manager, like making a living, but New York is expensive and you guys get it. Like it's tough. So I didn't make any payments on those loans until I started was like an actual writer on Brooklyn Nine-Nine. So it took me from the time I graduated to the time I was a working writer. It was like, I don't know, 3.5, 4 years, maybe five years that took me to get that job. Didn't make any payments. And so the interest really accrued. And now literally I'm going to be paying off my loans finally the end of this month. Yeah, thank you. But let me tell you what those payments ballooned to. These payments ballooned to like over $300,000. So like that's a shit ton of money. And I, in my mind, I made peace with it. I was like, look, I don't own a fancy car. I don't own a house. And I'm putting that off. This is an investment in myself. And I treated it like my mortgage. I bought something very, very important to me that has served me well. So I'm not mad at it. It's absolutely a crime. And we have to do something about it in this country. However, for me, it was worth it. And it did take me, I've been a professional writer for 11 years, took me 11 years, making a good writer salary to pay that off. So just be prepared, you know, for that as something. And that's, I will also say, everybody else that I went to school with that took on these loans has also been able to pay it off. So I do think like, it's not, there's always a chance, there's always a gamble that you'll take out this debt and still be chipping away at it later in life. But it's not going to prevent you from living your life. It's not going to prevent you from getting a job or being happy. It's just something you have to understand. It's a responsibility that you'll eventually be done with. But yeah, it's there. It takes time.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome.
Would you prefer a happier question or like a sadder question?
Whatever is most pressing in your brain.
Oh, okay. What would you say is the most rewarding part about being a showrunner?
Ooh, I get to pick who I hang out with all day. I love working in a writer's room. I love being with other funny, fun, cool people that have different perspectives on the world. I think one of the reasons I wanted to go into film and television is because I didn't want to do the same thing every day. It just seemed like I wouldn't, it wasn't for me. I was very truant in school. Like I never went to class because of the routine. I hated the fact that like every day was the same thing, the same types of lessons. And so I knew from my adulthood that I'd have to pick something with variety. And that's what I get as a showrunner. I mean, you get that as a TV writer as well, but I get to pick who I hang out with. And it's very, very fun. The other thing I will say that is very rewarding is being done with a project after working really hard on it and seeing how people receive the material, especially if it's very, very personal to you.
Thank you. That's a great answer.
That's the happy question, right? You want to ask me your sad one?
Sure. I was curious how you deal with rejection upon cancellations of like shows that are near to your heart.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, it's something I really don't think I've gotten good at yet, to be very honest. It's happened several times in my career. The first time it happened was on People of Earth. That one, at least we got to do two full seasons and we were starting a new narrative. So at least it kind of felt like we had closed the loop on something. It was a bummer, but it didn't feel like there was anything sort of like left hanging in the air. With Diary, that was really surprising and shocking, because I think so many people really responded to the material and it was such a positive and inspiring show for so many people. It's like, for me, that one was like, well, who doesn't want this goodness in the world? Like that was more of like an existential bummer. I think like, why wouldn't you want this on TV? And the same thing for Gordita Chronicles. I mean, that was something that really felt, like a collateral damage of weird corporate culture, that I'm not really sure how to process. It's easy for me to be like, well, that's not fair. And I don't think it is from my perspective, but I think it just sort of inspires me, or not inspire is the wrong word. I think fuels me to try to keep going, to get through, to get those good messages, those laughs, that representation through next time. It's just one of those things that sort of like when you're a kid and someone says you can't do something, you're like, oh, I can show you. I think it's more that feeling. So now that's sort of what I think myself and the creator have been feeling about that show.
Yeah, we've been talking about those shows for sure. And actually, can I have a follow-up?
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, like a lot of the shows that you've worked on, it seems like they work on a lot of different levels. There's a class that I teach and we talk a lot about cultural impact of television. And sometimes it's negative, sometimes it's positive, but there's some things that affect people and they see it on television and it changes their point of view. It changes how they see themselves. It just changes things. Mm-hmm. And it does seem like a lot of the projects you've worked on do affect people and have made impacts on their life. And I'm trying to think of how I'm framing this into a question. Well, I mean, how is that, like, you're trying to balance being a comedy and having that genre and also maybe doing something more? Was that always in your mind that that's what you wanted to do?
It was, and then it wasn't, and then it was again. I think I went through a real identity crisis as a person and as a writer in my life because I'm half Colombian and half New York Jew. And where I grew up, it wasn't cool to be either of those things. So I did a lot of whitewashing of myself growing up. And all the comedy that I saw on television was all very white centric. And like, I mean, that's not necessarily a bad thing. It's like it was a function of who was in the industry at the time and whose stories were being told. And that's what that's the comedy that raised me. And my goals growing up were to sound as much like a white man as possible in my comedy, the stories I told, because that's what I knew and that's how I knew I would get in. So it wasn't really until I started working in television that I realized that I had been experiencing professional misogyny on a workplace level, but also some internalized stuff, also some internalized racism that I was like hard to reckon with, and overt racism in the industry as well, that made me realize after a lot of like soul searching and connecting with my roots a bit more, defending my roots a bit more, and seeing how Latinos and Jews are portrayed in the media, I pivoted what my goal was, which was, yes, I want to be funny. And yes, I want to tell jokes and, you know, achieve that level of skill that I've always admired in the shows that I've loved. But also, it's important for me to be honest about who I am and my perspective and my POV and have representation in the story. So it's not, I was telling someone in another interview that all my samples that I wrote until like, and I was in my late 20s were through the, like had white male protagonists. Like I didn't start writing women or women of color as protagonists until like very late in my writing journey. And I think that's really telling. And I think that's a function of the Hollywood culture at the time. And so, yeah, to answer your question, no, it wasn't always. But now it is. And I think it's really important to tell stories that empower people, reflect people back in a positive way, and show, you know, the other thing, Gordita Chronicles is a really good example. I had an experience when I was starting out as a writer where a boss of mine had asked me in a very serious way, why aren't Latinos funny? Like, why aren't there more Latino comedy writers? I know, but it wasn't like a mean question. He was just legitimately was like, well, why? And I think it's just because you're not looking for us. You don't see us as you don't see us as that. And it was through his lens that I was like, oh, they don't know us as complete people. So my goal, like, especially with Gordita Chronicles and Gordita Chronicles also, you know, the creator has often, Claudia Forestieri has often talked about, one of the motivating factors of her for her to create the show was everything Trump was saying about Latinos, how he was painting us as, you know, criminals and rapists and murderers and drug dealers. And that's not our community. That's not who we know. You know, those are anomalies. And we really wanted to paint a picture of a Latino family that reflected us as complete people, including sense of humor. And humor is such a, I liken it to the Turing test, you know, that's how you know AI is intelligent, is if they can make a joke. Well, we were sort of treating it like that, like see us, now you know we're human, we're making jokes. Like there's more to us than sombreros and burritos, you know what I mean? So that was our goal with telling stories like that, is now it's like to really show society we're complete people just like you, and also to make shows for our culture, people that are first generation, people that just moved here, to let them have quality comedy that speaks to them as well.
Yeah. And so many people have commented to me about like the shows like One Day at a Time, and like how much it was just a relief to see the show. And it's very specific. But it's human, right? It's everyone can empathize, everyone can understand, and that's it should be a given, but it was just they were sane. Excellent. All right. Yes, and follow up over there. Get out of your way.
I mean, you might have just touched on it a little bit, but let me go like that.
Hey, what's your name?
Mason. My name's Mason. Yeah. But can you talk about, like, I guess how hard it is, like, convincing executives, like, that people want to watch stories about people of color, and like just pitching those shows and stuff.
Yeah, I'll say in the beginning of my career, it was very hard. Diversity wasn't cool yet. It was like still something that you kind of, Brooklyn Nine-Nine in my recollection was like the first show that had casting that was relatively diverse. And I was really happy to be a part of it. And it was, that was right around that time when people were like, oh yeah, we should probably be paying attention to everybody else. And it was tough in the beginning. You know, I'm a comedy writer, and the people who represented me at the time would send me like, do you want to adapt the story about a drug dealer? Do you want to adapt the story about people crossing the border? Do you want to adapt? And I was like, I'm a comedian. I was like, they just saw my ethnicity as like what I should be working on, these particular crisis oriented stories. And it took a long time for me to be like, hey, I can tell stories that involve my community, but aren't necessarily about the stereotypes that you think. So it was hard. At that time, it was sort of hard to get them to break out of the boxes how they saw me. They saw me exclusively as my ethnicity and not the types of themes and writing that I like to do. So that was like the first step in that. But then after a few years went by, there was a lot of, I mean, I really credit the Obama administration, to be honest, in terms of like really making diversity a thing. And Hollywood finally catching on that there's money to be made and being diverse. And so they started to get more like, oh yeah, no, we really do want to hear these stories. So they definitely would want to hear them and they would buy them. Whether they would get on the air is another question, because there seemed to be a disconnect between the people that wanted to develop the stories, producers and studio executives, and people on the network side of things who were actually putting them on the air. I think that's a good example of, or the big muckety mucks at the top, who HBO Max is a really good example of what something that's, or the merger of what's happening there. Everybody up to the point of our executives at HBO Max really tried to make the show a success, but the people at the very, very top who make those big high-level corporate decisions, there's like nobody of color on their board, the people that make those decisions. So there could be lots of diversity underneath, but if ultimately at the end of the day, the big guy writing the checks doesn't think your stories are worth it, you don't really have a shot. So the long answer is, I guess the short answer is I've seen it improve over the years. People didn't want to hear them at first, and now they say that they do. I just now I'm waiting for them to keep putting their money where their mouth is.
Yeah.
So I guess we'll see, right?
Yeah. All right. Thank you. Hello.
Hey. Hi. My name is Gonzalo. First off, my mom loves One Day at a Time, especially with Rita Moreno. She was like, oh my God, incredible.
Thanks, Mom.
Yeah, exactly. So you were talking about like trying to find that balance between like your Latino identity and like what people are expecting of you. And so I just like, could you touch on that a little bit more of like how you find that balance of like, I want to represent my community while not being tokenized?
Yeah, it's tricky. I think you have to have a good sense for which projects just inherently are tokenizing the types of stories. Like, yes, it's important to tell stories of everybody in the Latinx community. And that includes people that are involved in like, you know, crisis situations or even illegal activity. Those are they can be interesting stories, but there's so much to us. So I generally look for the project that speaks more to everyday human moments, I suppose, like the ideas about coming of age, romance, you know, aspirations and goals. Those are things that attract me a lot more. If I would want to watch them and they'd make me feel good at the end of the day, I invest my time in those, developing those projects. And it's something that I think has taken me a long time to know how to express. There's, you know, and I think a lot of other writers I've talked to about this have sort of felt this pressure. You know, we're not a monolith as a community. Everybody's different, has had their own experiences. I'm first generation. My experience is different than somebody who's immigrated here as a kid. They're second and third generation have even, you know, more different experience than mine or the, you know, the other person. So I think it's really all about getting very comfortable with what your own story is and your own point of view, because all those narratives are totally valuable. I used to think that because I wasn't like born in another country, it meant I wasn't Latina enough. And I think that's just like a symptom lots of writers and first gen people have. And now we're talking about it openly in the community. And that's an interesting topic even to discuss. That sort of weird competition. I'm more immigrant than you are kind of a thing. Mm-hmm. And then there's pushing back against the stereotypes that are inherent in the development process with studio. We have this joke among writers where people talk about the Miha pass, where like people, you know, they say, well, it's not feeling authentic or ethnic enough. We joke that you just put a couple Mihas in there and they usually, I mean, quells the request, but that's just because there's not a real understanding. There are people reacting to the fact that Latinx families feel so much like other families because we are. So it's really a funny sort of meta experience. You're trying to break down these barriers and people want to keep putting them up again. But in time, just keep chipping away at it, I think.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm. Hi, I'm Will.
Hey. Hey, Will.
From a lot of the classes we hear about, like when you first enter a writer's room and how there's certain like behaviors you have to adapt, like you don't want to talk too much or else you become overbearing and people don't like you at that point. But you also don't want to be quiet because people want to hear your opinion on that. So, but I was just curious if you had any other tips for when you first enter that writer's room, how to leave a solid mark, like leave a good presence.
Totally. Yeah, this is a great question because it can be very scary, especially like my experience was that my first day of work, I walked into a room with people that I had idolized my entire life. So it was really intimidating. And I also like knew what I didn't know. I was like, I'm very grateful to be here, but I know I'm a beginner, you know, I'm a staff writer. So one of the things that I learned, and when I became an older writer that I really appreciated in younger writers, was being like, even if you don't have a pitch, be supportive of other people's pitches who you like and verbalize that. Even something as small as, oh my God, that's really funny, really goes a long way to help move the conversation along because you're a litmus test for whether or not something's working. Or just being supportive in terms of like, supporting people's pitches. I really like that idea. Laughing is super helpful. And I think just being present, even if you don't have anything to say, if you do have something to say, great, but don't feel the pressure to do it. The expectations for a staff writer are really, really low. And I think what that job really is an apprenticeship. We understand you're a beginner writer and we want you to learn from us. We're trying to mold you into our image so that you can be helpful to us once you've watched and learned. So I would firstly just take the pressure off of yourself to contribute, learn, and be supportive. And that's going to help so, so much. And if you have a pitch, great, but don't put the pressure on yourself. You know, volunteer. Here's another tip. Volunteer to be helpful in ways like writing the note cards that you're going to put on the board, or coming up with episode ideas, just like basic A, B, and C story, just doing a little extra work, you know, in the evening. Little things like that can really help be supportive to the staff and will definitely leave an impression on your showrunner.
Hello. I'm Colby.
Hey, Colby.
So being a showrunner on Gordita, I imagine it was a lot of work. So I'm curious, like, what does an average day look like for you and how do you manage it all?
Mm, It's a great question. Yeah, it is. Showrunning is a lot of work. And I was very lucky. I had a lot of good partners, the creator, Claudia being one, and our writers were always very helpful and supportive. It was important to me for my writers to have a work-life balance because I have been on a lot of shows that didn't have that. And I always told myself, I'm not going to run a room like that. So we came in at 10 and we went home at 5:30 or 6 pretty much every day. There were a few nights where we stayed late, but those were pretty rare. So I would make an agenda for the day's work. And I would distribute it to everybody either the night before or the morning before that laid out a schedule of what we were doing. I would build in breaks so nobody was guessing when they could go to the bathroom or when they could make phone calls or whatever. Everybody knew when they had some chunks of time off. And the first thing that we would do in the morning was play lunch games. And lunch games is something a lot of writers' rooms do. And it's a competition to decide who gets to pick where we're eating lunch that day. But it has another function, which is that it warms everybody up. And so our lunch game, every room has different kinds of lunch games, and they get really, really crazy. For example, on Brooklyn Nine-Nine, I forget what they call it in the show, but that was like a reflection of our lunch games in the writer's room. So we would do everything from like Taboo to charades. We had everybody brought in games and a lot of them were really physical. So we would play these games. It would get us really laughing and having fun and warmed up. And then we would start breaking whatever story we were working on that day. Sometimes we split up into two rooms to sort of like make a little bit quicker progress. We would take lunch, have an hour lunch, come back and keep working on like coming up with stories. We got into the point where we would start having documents like outlines and scripts. I would often have to step out of the room to do my pass on them once the writers had turned them in. So it would take me away from the writer's room, but that I had a number two and the creator who could run the room in my stead. When I finished my documents or whatever notes calls I had with the studio or network, I would go back in the room and they would fill me in on what they'd done. We would talk some more and we would set up our plan for what we were going to accomplish the next day. After that, everybody went home. I would stay. Sometimes Claudia would stay. Sometimes my number two and another writer would stay, depending on what other work we had. Did we have to finish an outline? Did we have to finish a script or punch up a script? We would stay and work a little bit later. I generally went home around 8:30 or 9 every day and maybe had a little more work at the end of the day at home too, emails. When we started having casting, I would have to go home and watch casting tapes, costumes meetings. I'd have to review costumes. When we started shooting, there was even more going on because we had dailies to watch and we have to watch turn in cuts. And so as the show gets more and more complete, there are more and more tasks to do where it does sort of become like, you're working pretty late for a few months there, but, and lots of shows do it differently. They involve, you know, more people in the process. We didn't really have that luxury because we shot in Puerto Rico and our budget couldn't handle bringing our writers over to produce episodes. So we had a small number of people had to cover a big amount of work. So, yeah, that's basically what our days are like. And was there another part of your question I forgot?
I guess, like, how do you manage it? How do you manage it all?
I think keeping an agenda is good. Delegating is important. Like, whatever I don't absolutely have to do, I can rely on someone else to do. Like, I often relied on Claudia to watch a lot of the audition tapes. I would give my number two in one of the upper levels. I would let them take passes on things just to save some time. So delegating as much as you can with people that you trust. The personal aspects of my life, you know, didn't get as much attention. My partner was super supportive and understanding, and I thank him for that. My mom, I didn't get to see her very much. I didn't see my friends very much, but you just kind of tell yourself this is a finite amount of time that you have to really be focused and then you can resume your life. I made best efforts to see people on the weekend when I could, but I was often working on the weekend. So I won't lie, like there's a lot of work that needs to be taken care of. But again, it's for a short period of time and the work is rewarding and pleasurable. So, you know, and you make friends with the people that you're working. For example, like when I'd be editing on the weekends, I became great friends with my post supervisor, post producer, the editors. So yes, it's hard. And yes, it is a little bit out of balance, but you just do your best to delegate as much as possible and make it a pleasant experience.
Awesome.
What was it like, basically your schedule for like writing for streaming versus writing for like a network show?
Roughly the same. I mean, a lot less time because budgets are much tighter in streaming that I found. Generally, you get 2 weeks an episode. It would be ideal if you got a little bit more, but generally that's the formula for like a 22 episode season on broadcast. You get about 48 weeks of work. I think it's closer to 50, and then you take some time off because you're not working all the way through. But for streaming, we did 10 episodes. We had 20 weeks. It was about the same. Initially, we had to really fight for the 20 weeks. Initially, they offered us 14, and that's really, really tight to like turn around 10 scripts. So basically, networks will try to get you to write it in the shortest amount of time possible. But the reality is it just takes time to break a story. Like if you're breaking a story, say you have an episode, you take 3 days to sort of come up with a story area and break a rough bit, then an extra 2 days to actually get all the beats down. Then another person goes off and over the weekend writes the outline. Then you have to wait for notes to come back for the outline. And then you do a revision on the outline. And then you have like 3 more days left to write the script. And then it's just like, it's a lot and it doesn't quite fit, but just somehow make it work. And sometimes it spills over into 22 weeks. Like we didn't have all of our scripts done when we went to production. So we kept on a few writers after that to keep writing because we weren't able to finish. So the scheduling, it's roughly the same in as much as you never really have enough time, but yeah.
I have 2 questions, but my first one is, how often do you see international or foreign writers in the writer's room and working on the show? And do the roles they're given depend on their visas?
Yes, they do. So we shot in Puerto Rico, which is part of the States, but our story is about a Dominican family, and we really wanted to cast a lot of Dominicans, for example. We couldn't because of the visa process, and that sucked. I have never had an international writer on anything I've worked on, and I don't know if that's a function of it being possible or impossible or just who the showrunner wanted, but I do think if you are here on a visa that allows you to work, it really shouldn't be a problem. Like if you have a work visa or an artist visa, I honestly don't know the other types of visas, but I don't see why it would be a problem. Yeah.
Thank you. And my second question is, from your experience, how hard is it for international writers to sell their shows, especially if it's not set in the West and also not centered on white people and characters?
I think I can probably only speak to the centering on non-white characters. As I was telling Mason, I think it's getting easier. Comedies are tricky because the argument we get back is that comedy doesn't travel. So like if you're, you know, what we find funny here may not be funny in another country and vice versa. With dramas, I think there's quite a bit of interest in other stories from other countries and other, you know, cultures. I think like a lot of like the Korean dramas have proven that there's a market you know, in America for that, or in English speaking countries for that, subtitles go a long way. I think those are actually for networks like that have platforms that are international, like Netflix. I think there's a market for sure. For something like Hulu, which is only in America, no, not so much. I think you would have to really focus on the streamers that have markets in multiple international countries.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Tessa.
Hey, Tessa.
You had mentioned having some like workplace discrimination issues, which I think is something that keeps a lot of women and gender minorities out of the industry. So how do you actually stand up to that in the workplace without being scared of losing your job?
When it happened to me, I did not. My response was to continue to push back harder and advocate for myself through working harder, which I don't know if it's a very effective strategy. I don't think it was actually in the end. It took me a long time to understand and unlearn cultural things that I had been brought up with. I'm very happy for this younger generation who has been raised with the values of equity, and they've been, you know, sort of taught not to accept less. Whether or not that's the reality, I'm not sure, but I have noticed that younger people that I work with are so much more in tune with what's okay and what isn't, and I love seeing that. You know, when it happened to me a little bit later in my career, I was really like stunned, to be honest, and because it can happen from people that with you trust and love even. And it's a function of sort of learning what you can discuss comfortably with somebody and then get over if they are willing to learn from it, or what needs to be escalated into HR. You know, writers have a problem with HR, which is that we don't really we're not like a regular business, in as much as like there isn't a I'm the manager on site. Do you know what I'm saying? And so people can bring things to me and I can deal with them to the best of my ability. But oftentimes, if something is serious enough, they think the showrunner is obligated to take it to HR at the studio level. And that's a scary thing to do. But the experience I was talking about, when something did like that did happen to me, it took me like a month to process what happened and then another week to decide what I wanted to do about it. And ultimately, it ended up being okay. And we were able to work through it. And I still regard this person as a colleague and a friend, but I know that's not the case for a lot of people in their experiences. That's like the best possible outcome of something like that. I would just say, know that you can always talk to your studio HR person, even if you're not on the studio lot. Make sure you know who that contact is. That person is there to help navigate weird situations like that. And also your union rep. My union is very, very active and very, very, the Writers Guild is very, very proactive about preventing discrimination and harassment. We've had, for writers and showrunners, for management, we've had workshops on how to identify all kinds of things, microaggressions and discriminations, you know, in all sorts of ways. And I think there's, you know, we're working on being better at that. But I think as a writer, I would say, like, know that it's never okay, and there's always going to be someone who can help you through it, whether at the union level, your showrunner, or HR at the studio.
So going from writing to like the showrunning position, shouldering a lot more responsibility, does the margin for error get a lot slimmer? Do you find yourself having to for lack of a better term, like deal with a bit more crises on the fly, have to like respond to things a lot more urgently? And are there any bits of the position that are more forgiving than others?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really interesting question, the margin for error. Well, you know, I guess there's technically you can't make errors in art unless you're being a bigot, I guess. That's my my take, I suppose. But in terms of like the practical and logistical stuff, yeah, as you get closer and closer to production, there is less and less margin for error, because especially for us, when we were filming in Puerto Rico, we had to ship in a lot of, bring a lot of things into the island. And so it was very much a measure twice, cut once situation, because there wasn't enough time to get the costume we needed, for example, the picture car we needed, if we didn't plan for it ahead of time. So I would say in the writing process, you can kind of, it's like the best time ever, because you're just blue skying ideas and everything is possible and you're working in your imagination and it's fun. And so there's a, you have a lot of leeway, I think, during the writing process. As you get further and further along, I would think of it as like a decrescendo. You have a lot of leeway, but as you move closer and closer to the room being done and they're getting closer to production, the margin for error that's allowable is less and less and less. And say, for example, you have more freedom in the beginning of the writer's room than you do halfway through, because things are now due. And if it's a serialized story, episode 5 depends on what happened in episode 4. And so if you don't get episode 4 done in time, episode 5 is going to be a bit of a rush job. And if it's a rush job, maybe you won't get as great feedback from the network and they're going to make you rewrite it, which gives you less time for production to like execute all the elements that you want to have into it. So I would always think of it like that, as like, just sort of, you have to be more and more focused the closer and closer you get to shooting.
Gotcha. Cool. Thank you so much.
My name is Troy, and I have two questions for you. So starting off, I think you touched on this with Mason and Len. So when you are kind of, you know, creating a show that's not centered on white characters or whiteness, or, you know, that familiarity of the West, would you, like, how much weight do you give to audience reaction?
Well, if it's the audience that you're writing to, I think a lot. I think it was really, really gratifying to see the Latino reactions to Gordita Chronicles and to see what it meant to them. But it was gratifying in a totally other way to see the reactions we were getting from the non-Latino audiences, because it meant something different to them in a good way. So I think, you know, are you talking about like after the fact, after people have seen it, or are you talking about as you're conceiving of the project? Do I consider that?
Like a little bit of both, like, because executives, of course, you know, they have money on the brain. They want, you know, not only to see that your show has legs, but also, you know, that you have a viewership. So it's like, how much would you say, you know, in comparison, does that factor into your writing process? And then later on, as the show is kind of picking up.
Mm-hmm. It does not factor into my writing process. My goal is to tell a good and funny story about an interesting character. Generally, those characters are a reflection of my life, so they tend to be Latina women. So no, I don't think about it really. I think my goal is always to tell a really good story. And then afterward, yes, of course, I consider it, because I'm sensitive to how things are received, not in a bad way, but I'm just like aware of them. And I think, would that influence what happened in the next season? You know, I've been on shows where like Twitter reaction to things has influenced certain things in our writing. Like, we've taken the opportunity to adjust a POV that may not have been as inclusive as possible, or we may have taken a beat to adjust a character's arc because we realized, oh, there's an opportunity to speak to an audience that didn't feel connected. So yeah, I think you can use it as like a tool to help you make your story better, but I wouldn't let it sway you one way or the other with regard to the type of story you're telling. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes complete sense. And then so for question two, since you work a lot with streaming, would you say mm-hmm. that it's easier to pitch limited series, you know, to have like a self-contained story, pitch it as like no. an 8-hour? No, it's not.
No, people don't want limited series. I think they're very, very rare. I think people want to have shows that run multiple seasons and make them lots of money. I think there are some streamers that will do limited series, but generally it's not been advisable, or I've been told that that's not the ideal business situation for studios.
Wow. Okay. Well, thank you so much.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, that's interesting. The limited series, like even when they are greenlit, if they do well, they come back and it's not a limited series anymore.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know why they call it limited series. It might be some kind of a technicality based on number of episodes ordered that I'm not aware of, but that seems like could be possible.
Yeah, originally it was going to be like that if it didn't do so well, but then if there's a lot of viewers, it's like, oh.
Have you guys been talking a lot about limited series in your class?
I mean, I'm just over all the classes I do, we do talk a lot about shows that are on, things that are greenlit, things that people are looking for. And like what is a limited series? But oh, yes. You know, I actually had a question that I was really curious about, especially like Gordita Chronicles. How do you, as a showrunner, you work with the creator of a series to support their vision, but it kind of becomes yours as well? Like how do you take their show that they came up with and make it yours, I guess?
Well, I guess I only have this particular experience to reference, which was a really positive one. You know, I was very lucky that Claudia and I had a relationship before this project. We both were in the Writers on the Verge Diversity Lab through NBC in 2013.
Oh, wow.
So we had already known each other. So there was a certain level of trust, I think, and there already. It was her personal story. So that's indisputable. What happened to her happened, and there are some really wonderful, sad, heartfelt, beautiful moments in there. So my job was to protect those and elevate them. And Claudia likes to joke, and she says that I take her sad stories, I make them funny. But that's an interesting part of our collaboration, is that like we have both have things that complement each other. So Claudia is a very funny writer in herself, but she, you know, my experiences in comedy and making jokes about things, and that was her life. So we kind of just blended, we supported each other. She would remember things or talk about issues that were close to her, and I would sort of try to transpose them into comedy scenarios that occurred to me. It's a little bit hard to sort of like, there wasn't like a pedagogy or a technique necessarily that I implemented to do that, but it was more of like her giving me a gem and I was polishing it, I guess is how I would say.
Okay. And I don't know how much you can talk about this, but mm-hmm. I'm curious on something. Say like, I don't know, who's the boss? How are you balancing? How could you balance the original show with your point of view and sensibilities and what you're bringing if you're leading this show?
Yeah. So I'm a huge Who's the Boss fan from the original. I grew up watching it. I was obsessed with it. So when this opportunity came, it was like a no-brainer for me. So what Mike and I wanted to do with this project, we were very lucky in that Tony Danza and Alyssa Milano both signed on to the project, right? So in a way, that dictated what the show was going to be. that meant we had the original canon of the show to honor. We had these original characters to honor, and we wanted to fast forward 30 years to see where they were now. So in a way, we had to honor those things as they were, and there was a little bit of room for us to expand. So there's three new characters in the reboot who are our efforts at including diversity in a show that wasn't necessarily original, inherently diverse in the 80s and early 90s. So we have done our best to keep the original concept, intent, spirit, heart intact, while adding some great new elements that I think are really, really elevate the original material. I'm vague, I know, but that's what, that's my answer.
That's more than I thought you would be able to tell us. So thank you.
Yeah, sure.
We've all been talking about, you know, the show reboot that.
Oh, yeah.
And it is kind of like a love letter. Like, it is a very warm, nice view. It's funny, but it sounds like it would be a lot of fun, especially like being a fan of the original show and being able to bring that and then add your elements to it. That sounds
totally cool. I feel like when I watch reboot, I was telling Mike that I can't tell if I feel seen by the show or if I'm being roasted. I can't tell. But it's great. I've really been enjoying it. And it's been a really like lovely experience working with everybody on the reboot. It hasn't been anything like that. But there, you know, there's it's just been it's been great. It's been like a dream come true. And to work with Norman Lear on top of it all is like, I can't believe it. I mean, we worked on One Day at a Time, but like, he's just phenomenal. And to be included in that stable of writers that have gotten to work with him is just like amazing.
Yeah. And I think it's like knowing that you and Mike Royce are on it, and then right, having Norman Lear, it's like, yeah, you're like, oh, this is more and more and more interesting. Like, this is,
yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I do teach like a whole class on Norman Lear.
So. Oh, you do? Oh, that's awesome.
I really do the deep dive, but yeah, I enjoy talking about him.
You guys have any follow-ups here? I know that you're gonna have to go soon.
Bailey, come on.
About who's the boss. How far into the process are you guys at this moment, if you can?
Sure. We this morning turned in our network draft to Freevee, which is where it's going to be streaming it. So hopefully we'll hear from them next week and get their notes. And the way our deal is with them is that if they like this, it's a script to series order. So if they like the pilot, they'll order one more script. And if they like that second script, then they'll order the series. So it's instead of shooting a pilot, basically, because we know what the show is. It's more about do the new elements of our show work, essentially.
Have you done that process before? Like for the, or like instead of like filming pilots or whatever, have you often found that they do the like two scripts?
I've never had personally something I've created. I've never done that. I have been on one other show that has done that, which was Love Life. Love Life was script to series. So we actually rewrote the pilot as a writer's room like 100 times and then we shot it. So it's an interesting model. I'm not sure why they do it. My guess would be, I mean, obviously to save money, but there's got to be another strategy to it. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Yeah. Oh, come on. Get one more in.
Some kneeling too tall.
Oh, here you go.
Hi, I'm Nick.
Hi, Nick.
When you're going and like starting in a writer's room for the show, do you usually take it like one season at a time, or do you have like the entire idea of the series kind of mapped out in your head when you start?
Oh, as a showrunner, you mean? Yes, there's the first 2 weeks in our writer's room, it depends. Some people, and this is the example of a very, very good showrunner, will come in with the whole season pretty much mapped out. Not like in super duper detail, but they know the beginning, middle, and end of the arc of the main character. And we had something like that. We had a Bible that was part of the pitch and part of the sales process for the show, for Gordita. And off of that, we had several episode ideas that we knew we wanted to hit. And we kind of knew where we wanted it to end. So we had a rough idea. And then we spent the first 2 weeks with the writers mapping out the whole season and deciding what we wanted the arc for every character to be, and then pitching episode ideas that would fit and support those arcs. Mm-hmm. In the process, you can't help but think of what would happen in season two after your last two episodes. So inherently, sometimes you're thinking about the beginning of season two when you're thinking about the end of season one in the first 2 weeks of the writer's room. So yes, generally you spend the beginning part of the writer's room mapping things out.
Murphy, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Yeah, thank you. Everyone here has been working on their own series and have gotten a pitch brief together and a presentation, and we're gonna be working, developing the series. Fine. The class, and then they'll continue with the next class. So yeah, that's really, really helpful. Really appreciate it.
Super fun.
Well, yeah. I don't want to take up any more of your time because this has been extremely generous and really, really useful to this class.
I'm so glad. And what a fun class you guys have and a great opportunity to learn. And you seem like you've had a great program there.
It's been fun. They've been working on it at DePaul. It's been nice.
Good luck, you guys.
Oh, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Have a great one. Bye.
Bye.
Forever Dog.
This has been a Forever Dog production. Executive produced by Brett Boehm, Joe Cilio, and Alex Ramsey. For more original podcasts, please visit foreverdogpodcasts.com and subscribe to our shows on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Keep up with the latest Forever Dog news by following us on Twitter and Instagram @ForeverDogTeam and liking our page on Facebook.